I'm Greg Truex interviewing Doug Adair on March 11th, 1995. It's 10:57 in the morning. And when we left off, it seemed like a natural place would be to go back and talk about your decision to leave the union and actually get to work with your hands again.
Well, I'd been working for the union steadily on union staff since September of 1965. And I joined the union because I liked to work in the fields. I liked farm work. And had assumed that once we won union contracts in the grapes, I would go back to work in the fields and work in the grapes. And we finally won those contracts in the spring and summer of 1970. I was on the boycott in Philadelphia at that time. But the union asked me to stay on because a strike had just broken out in the lettuce in Salinas, and we were not sure whether a new boycott would be begun or just exactly what would be happening. We were in a new jurisdictional dispute with the Teamsters. And so I agreed to stay on at least to help the new staff get set up in Philadelphia that was going to be coming out from Salinas. And then, in fact, that winter of 1970, after the boycott had begun, they asked Harriet Teller and me to transfer to St. Louis and set up a new boycott operation in St. Louis, where there was no staff at all at that time. So all through that period, I continued to work for the union on partly on the lettuce boycott, and then there were negotiations with the lettuce growers and with the Teamsters, and then we were boycotting wine, and then non-union lettuce, and various different boycotts continued through late 1970 and early 1971, more or less under the focus of the lettuce boycott, but various different things were going on at that time.
Were there other, they were other boycotts, or were there other kinds of activities?
Well, both. And there were political things happening at that time. But at any rate, I was eager to get back to the fields, and each of these different operations seemed important, but call it selfish or whatever. I was ready to go off union staff and go back to work in the fields. And so in December of 1971, I gave the union plenty of advance notice that I was going to leave and at least go back to work in the pruning. And whether I came back on staff or not, I wasn't sure. But I wanted to experience the benefits of the union contract, what we'd been fighting for all these years. So I went back to Delano.
That was the winter of 71?
This would have been December of 1971.
Okay.
The first week in December.
All right.
And I knew that the pruning started the last week in November, the first week in December of 1971. And so I kind of focused my resignation from union staff to coordinate with the beginning of the pruning season so I could get a job. Mm-hmm. And I went back to the union hiring hall in Delano. And the setup was very beneficial for someone like me in that all the companies in the area that wanted workers were submitting their work orders at that time. And so I could kind of pick and choose among the different companies. And the company, my main criteria was I was a single guy, no place to live, no family. I was interested in a company that had a camp, that had a labor camp that I could live in. And at the union hiring hall, they had a list of the different camps that were available. And I said, by any chance, do you know where my friend Rudy Reyes is working? And I think it was Cynthia Bell or Esther or Randy, one of the people in charge of the hiring hall, said, oh, I think he's out at Tenneco Ducor, camp number one. And they'll be having a dispatch on whatever day it was, Wednesday or Thursday. And be here bright and early and get in line, and you'll have your chance the same as everyone else. And in those days, there was some resentment among some of the people that had worked on union staff for a long period of time, feeling that we should have some kind of extra seniority, that we should be able to jump in front of everyone else in line. But it didn't bother me, because I had kind of planned my return to the fields to be at a time when there should be plenty of work, so I didn't need to be at the front of the line. There were plenty of jobs. And I got the job to the camp I wanted, which turned out to be a mostly Arabian camp. Most of the workers were from Yemen, maybe 60%, and about 30% were from the Philippines, and then there were a couple of Mexicans and me. And the camp had just gone through a very difficult period before I got there, which had had a very radicalizing effect on the camp. When the union contracts first came in 1970 after the boycott, in effect, the grower signed the contract and then told the workers the contract is signed. It wasn't quite that. I mean, workers signed authorization cards. But in many crews and in many camps, there was no real understanding at that point of what the new contracts were going to mean. And the contract that was actually signed at this ranch, I think, was signed with the Bank of America. The company had really originally been the Divisich Ranch, J.J. Divisich or something or other, who'd been one of these old-time Yugoslavian pioneer date growers, and had built up a ranch of about 5,000 acres, but had gotten into financial trouble in the late 1960s and had gone bankrupt. And Bank of America had foreclosed on him, I think, just before the union was finally victorious. So the original contract, I think, was with Bank of America. And then Tenneco Farming Company, which was part of the Tenneco Oil Company conglomerate, bought up this particular ranch. So it became known as Tenneco Ducor. Mm-hmm. And it had about, maybe six or eight different farm labor camps, each of which would have housed about 100 workers. And at the height of the season, had well over 1,000 workers working mm-hmm. for it. At the height of the season, it would also be family crews and crews from the Porterville area, from the Delano area, from the Rich Grove area, in addition to the camp crews. But the camp crews, of course, were all men. And the union dispatch system gave out dispatches without regard to race, creed, or color. Traditionally, a camp and a crew would be very much, influenced by the foreman, who would put together a crew, perhaps primarily of his own friends and family, perhaps primarily of his own race. There would be crews that were overwhelmingly Filipino, crews that were overwhelmingly Mexican, crews that were overwhelmingly from Michoacan, crews that were overwhelmingly from Porterville. It kind of depended on the foreman where he recruited the workers for his crew. Mm-hmm. And the Arabs were a new group in the situation. There were a couple of Arab foremen, but very few. And since the Arabs were single men, they tended to gravitate towards crews that had a camp, where they could live in the camp. Mm-hmm. But they ran into quite a bit of discrimination, especially from the Filipino foreman. And in our particular crew, the foreman had charged the Arabs extra money for getting a bed in the camp, had charged them $5 a ride for a ride into town, had made a profit on the food that you would pay so much for your meals. Well, he made a significant profit off the Arab workers, and maybe a little profit off the other workers too. But the Arabs seemed to get extra discrimination simply because they couldn't speak English or Spanish. They were like a captive labor force. And really at the mercy of the employer and the labor contractors and the foreman and everyone up and down the line. When the union contracts came in, they could get a dispatch to any crew, regardless of whether the foreman wanted them or not. It was non-discriminatory. So all of a sudden, Arabs began showing up in crews where there had been no Arabs before. And they would tend to go to crews where other Arabs were. So our crew, which had been, I gather, before the union had been mostly Filipino with a few Arabs, was now mostly Arab, but still with a significant number of Filipinos, some of whom had been there for years and years and years. And also within that crew, an old union staff member, Macario Bustos, ended up in that crew, had had a drinking problem, his family had come apart, he'd left union staff, ended up in this crew. And for whatever his problems were with alcohol, he had a tremendous heart of gold and a tremendous radical union perspective on his fellow man, his brothers and sisters. And right away he began, well, for instance, in relation to a ride to town, he had an old beat-up car, but he'd tell people, "I'm going to town. Is there anything I can pick up for you? Do you need a ride?" And it wasn't that he was trying to make money off people. He had a little asset, and could he share it with his brothers? Well, a tremendous difference in people's lives right away when you're as that isolated, as especially as the Arab community was. It was about 15 miles from Delano and about, maybe 20 miles south of Porterville, but way out in the country, and there weren't any stores or anything near at all. Right away, he began being interested in what was being charged for the food, and under the union contract for the first time, I'm not sure whether it was a clause in the contract or it was just assumed that the camps would be run on a non-profit basis, and that the foreman or company wasn't going to make a profit off the food. The workers would pay for the food, they were going to pay their fair share, but Macario began checking the receipts for what had been bought. And if the food had been bought, did it end up in the kitchen, you know, available to the workers, or did it end up at the foreman's house or somewhere else? Almost as soon as he got there, he began contributing these new perspectives on life, so to speak, that began to change what was going on in that camp. And then, at some point in 1971, Rudy Reyes had moved there, who'd also been, he was a young Filipino, had been one of the leaders of the strike in 1965, had worked on union staff, had worked on the boycott, again, was a fearless and radicalized young worker that knew his rights and knew to stand up for his rights, and again, added this whole new element into the camp life, and being a Filipino, could speak to the other Filipinos, could organize them. And in part, they were losing, the Filipinos were losing their privileged position, in a sense, because the foreman had been able to give them special benefits. And if someone showed up late, and the pruning had already begun, and the camp was almost full, the foreman could always find someone from his home village, or from his mother's cousins, whatever, you know, there was always a place in the camp for a Filipino. Whereas an Arab, no, the camp is full, or you might have to pay a significant bribe under the table to get a place in the camp.
And but the union, could. There was that kind of opportunity.
Maybe. But all of that was past history with the contract. First of all, you couldn't get into the you couldn't get a job at all with the company unless the company had sent in a work order saying they needed workers. And then the dispatches were handed out regardless of race, creed, or color. Now, if you had seniority, the seniority system was not well worked out in those days. And if you had seniority, we would have what was called a seniority dispatch, and usually the first day of a work order would be reserved for seniority workers. Mm-hmm. And if you were there, and you'd worked there the last season, you got to go out. And then if there were still spaces, they were open to new workers. The problem was, if you'd been there the previous season and had seniority, but had not gotten back from the Philippines or from Oaxaca or from South Texas or Stockton or wherever, and you were late, there was no way to defend your spot in the crew, mm-hmm. so to speak. And that caused problems. So later, when I was working at the David Friedman Company, the system was quite different. Rather than a dispatch, you'd have a recall. The notice would be sent out at least a week before work was expected to start to your last known address. And you were automatically in the crew if you'd finished the season and were on the final payroll the year before. You were automatically in the crew that season, and you had 3 days to show up. And if you couldn't show up in those 3 days, you could put in a petition for an extension or an excuse or whatever, so there'd still be a space there for you when you got back. Mm-hmm. In the early contracts in 1973, it wasn't that, how do you say, that flexible. And so the worst seniority workers that didn't get in felt real resentment.
Mm-hmm. Is this what you meant when you said it had there been a radicalizing sort of set of things that occur in the camp of difficulty, or was that more about the way the foremen were, or is that part of the same radicalizing experience?
Well, first of all, who hires you is crucial to farm workers. And is it the foreman or is it the union? So right away, the workers owed their jobs not to the foreman, but mm-hmm. to the union. They owed their beds in the camp not to the foreman, but to the union.
Yes.
All of a sudden, the foreman couldn't tell them what to pay for food. They were going to pay what the food costs, and the union was going to keep an eye on that to make sure it was right. Now, in some camps, the question of food never was really resolved, and there was some foreman that still had tremendous power within their crews, and there wasn't any strong union member in that crew that was strong enough to stand up for the foreman mm-hmm. and say, "You're cheating us." But in our crew, that we had gotten way past that stage.
So it depended to some extent on what actual crew you were in.
Right, and each crew was at different stages of development under mm-hmm. the union contract. Caesar had once compared the situation on a farm to what he called the ranch nation. And he said the patron is like the absolute monarch. He's the king, and he has his own private security guards. He has his own private judges and enforcement system, and his rule is law, and nobody challenges him. And he's life and death. And with the union coming in, it was like you're changing that to an absolute monarchy. And the union contract is the Constitution. But, of course, the Constitution is the contract is just words on a page unless the workers really exercise their rights and defend their rights. And in some crews, the workers defended their rights right to the maximum, mm-hmm. every single possible right. And in fact, there would be grievances which were borderline frivolous. So-and-so got to work 8 hours on Saturday, and we only got to work half a day, and how come they got to work 8 hours, and we only worked four, and I'm higher seniority than them, and, well, which crew was higher seniority, and who was, and it just, there were issues like that that people felt strongly about it. I mean, because why did that guy get an extra half day's wage, and why didn't I? But there were issues that were, kind of nitpicking in mm-hmm. a sense. But there were other issues that were absolutely crucial, but none of them were put on the table as a grievance unless the worker was willing to stand up and say, hey, this is not fair, this is an injustice.
In a constitutional monarchy, the monarch often is just a figurehead. When the contract came in, did the owners get more removed from actual operations, or is this just a...
Well, in our particular company, the man on the scene was a man named John Zaninovich. We called him Big John because he was about, he was over 6 feet tall, probably 200, 250 pounds. And the union representative that was assigned to our particular ranch was named Juan Flores, who was a little over 5 feet tall. He was Little John. And it was a kind of David and Goliath situation.
Mm-hmm.
But Big John took his orders from Bakersfield, which was where Tenneco Farming Company was headquartered. And Bakersfield took their orders from Houston, mm-hmm. where the Tenneco conglomerate was headquartered. And Tenneco and all had 2 million acres of land and another million in Australia, and they made nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers and oil wells, and I mean it was all over the world, a huge conglomerate. And so in that sense, the real power was very far removed and very peripherally involved mm-hmm. in the actual going on at our particular ranch. There were other ranches where the boss, the founder of the ranch might be an older Yugoslavian or Italian that might have been out there in the 30s planting the vines with the mm-hmm. workers and really felt a very deep personal involvement in the ranch and might fight tooth and nail for all his rights. And regardless of the contract being signed, he never really accepted it in his heart, or he might accept it in his heart. And there were some of these old pioneers that in the 30s, in the thinning season, which comes in the spring, and you're thinning the grapes, trying to get ready for the harvest. And the boss was out of money, and it was the Depression, and how to get the thinning done. And this was told to me by older Filipinos, the crew would work for him for room and board, for free, for maybe a month, maybe 2 months,
mm-hmm.
getting the thinning done so that then when the harvest came in, he could pay them back. And he would have a very close relationship with those workers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, would owe the farm to those workers. The bank, if he hadn't been able to cover whatever the bank had loaned, he would have lost the ranch. The workers saved the ranch for him.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those workers some of those older growers were very loyal to their workers, and some weren't loyal at all. And some of them had been replaced by the younger generation,
mm-hmm.
who could be heartless, who could be hateful. But it depended ranch to ranch, and it also depended on the workers ranch to ranch. And there were workers on some ranches that were content with the wage raise of the union and a little bit of a change here and a little bit of a change there, but aside from that, really went right on working as they had before. A few benefits, but really didn't push things. And there were other ranches that picked up that contract and said, hey, Thomas Jefferson, hey, we're equal and we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they wanted everything they could possibly get out of that ranch contract, and they pushed it to the limits. And Tenneco tended to be one of those ranches where we were organizing the workers to demand every possible benefit they could get from mm-hmm. the company and also from the union.
Mm-hmm.
And the union had a service center. Well, if we had a worker that had a problem with Social Security or with health insurance or the family back home or whatever, we'd go into the union, and if there was someone there to help or taxes or whatever. Also, those of us in the camp that spoke English and could make our way around in American society on an individual basis would help workers. I helped Arab workers get the first driver's licenses in California, I think. Certainly some of the first farm workers. But there was a DMV office in Arvin that allowed workers to take tests that couldn't read and write, and especially couldn't read and write English. And the guys that I took down there, I made them study and study and study, and boy, they knew all the signs, and they knew all the laws, and they knew how to drive, but they didn't know English. And they were driving, and it seemed to me important that they get their license. And we went down there, and I remember we got about, I think we got two licenses or three licenses. But again, the word spread through the Arab community right quickly that the union will help you get a driver's license.
Did you speak Arabic?
Well, I spoke enough. I spoke quite a bit. Mm-hmm. By 1973, I'd been living in the camp for 2 years. I spoke a lot and could understand a lot. But on the question of how removed or how close the actual boss was to the ranch, at this Tenneco Ducor camp that I was in, after Tenneco had bought the ranch, they fed something through their computer, I presume, that said that told the company, oh, the harvest season ends in early November, and the pruning doesn't start till early December. And if you turn off the electricity in this camp for 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever it is, you'll save $100 or $200 or whatever it was. Yeah. Here's a company with a $3 billion profit, you know, and they're trying to save $50 off their farm workers. And here are single guys who, where do they go for a month? I mean, there's no housing in town. There's no housing around there. It's way out in the country. Where do you go for a month? And no other work. And they're all on the seniority list, and they're all going to work in the pruning. And the foreman told them, get out. We have to leave. And he left. And some of the workers left. But most of the workers stayed. And the union said, we'll help you to stay here. This is just outrageous. There's no reason you should leave. You're going to be going back to work in a couple more weeks, and stay here. This is totally unfair. And it's a change under the contract. You have what's called a maintenance of standards. You can't change conditions that have existed in the past to the detriment of the workers, or unless you negotiate it with the union. So they refused to move. And the order came from Houston to Bakersfield to Ducor, turn off the gas, turn off the electricity, which they did. The company did. So the workers began cooking their food out in campfires in front of the ranch. And in November, by late November in the Central Valley, it can be very cold, very foggy.
Oh, yeah.
And they made their Thanksgiving dinner on campfires out in front of the ranch, and they invited the TV stations up from Bakersfield to record this. And the company was finally so humiliated at that point that the word got back to somebody in Bakersfield, to Houston, to wherever. Forget it, you know. I mean, this is absurd. We're getting international bad publicity over pennies. Why on earth are we doing this? So when I moved back in, they had just gotten the electricity turned back on and the gas turned back on. But psychologically, this was a tremendous victory for the workers, that in their mind, they had stood up to this injustice. They had stood up to this huge conglomerate organization, and they'd won. And talk about the power of the union, people that had been kind of sitting on the fence and not sure until that time, wow, they saw that the union really could make a difference in their lives. Tremendous.
What year had this Thanksgiving happened in?
This was 1971. This was like the week before I got there.
Uh-huh.
And in the aftermath of this, the people in the camp voted, they voted a couple of things. They voted that the people that had left couldn't come back to our camp. That we decided who could live in our camp, and no matter if the union had given a dispatch or not, these people couldn't come back. Now, this wasn't something that the union decided. This was something that the workers in the camp had decided. And they also filed a grievance against the foreman, that they didn't want the foreman back. And during this time, they had done the research on all the ways the foreman had been cheating the workers in the camp, and they presented this to the company. And in fact, the foreman was dismissed by the company. Mm-hmm. And the new foreman that was brought in, Bonifacio Carreo, again, in a sense, owed his job to the union. So he was not a union, strong union supporter. In those days, the foreman was a union member, and mm-hmm. we could discipline him. We could call him in on a grievance, and the second foreman, and the checker. And we had a couple of grievances with the foreman and the second foreman, both of whom were Filipino. But mostly, he respected the union and didn't try to cheat the workers, was very honest with the food, or was pretty honest with the food. A little bit ended up in his refrigerator, but that's all right. The best cuts of meat, I'm sure, ended up on his table and not ours, but that's all right.
That was clearly an improvement.
Oh, a tremendous improvement. And by the time I got there, to me, it was a couple of the best years of my life. I loved working at Tenneco, a wonderful group of guys. The foreman, I didn't have any problem with the foreman.
How long were you at Tenneco?
It was about 2 years. Two pruning seasons, two thinning seasons.
Were there changes in those 2 years in the way, as far as where you were working, the way that the union handled things, were there changes? Is a contract written year to year, or?
Those contracts were a three-year contract. They were signed in 1970, and they expired in 1973. Mm-hmm. And in 1973, the Tenneco and most of the big grape companies signed sweetheart contracts with the Teamsters Union. And we lost the contracts at that point. And this was without any vote, without any consultation with the workers. It was just something done in Bakersfield or Houston or wherever.
I really don't understand this. It seemed to me that UFW had become the bargaining agent for people who signed on, and there had been an election to be certified as a representative. How did the Teamsters simply circumvent that, or am I misunderstanding how it worked?
There was no law, so there was nothing specific regulating how recognition would come about. Oh. And the truth was, in 1970, we got those contracts because of the boycott. Mm-hmm. The growers couldn't sell their grapes without the union, the Eagle. And at that point, they agreed to sit down and negotiate with the union. Mm-hmm. But in effect, they were already admitting that they had been beaten mm-hmm. on this economic level by the boycott. And then before we signed any contract, the union would present to the company signed authorization cards by the workers. And at that point, the employer didn't oppose us going out, the union organizers going out and getting the card signed, because they needed the Eagle. They wanted mm-hmm. the Eagle. With the Teamsters, they signed the contract with the Teamsters mm-hmm. and then told the workers, if you don't sign the Teamster card, you're out of here. And in fact, broke into my room and trashed a lot of my stuff. And it was a very difficult period for people if there'd been an election, we would have won overwhelmingly at Tenneco. But there was no election. And most of the workers, I think, would have gone out on strike, except that on April 15th, there weren't many workers working at Tenneco. It was our off-season. And so when people came back from Stockton or wherever, they were told, if you want to work here, you have to sign a Teamster card.
When they broke into your room, were they targeting you for a reason?
Well, I had a big union Eagle on my door, so mm-hmm. that was
fairly clear.
Right.
But it wasn't because you had been on staff or...
No.
But you weren't there at that
but
time.
But I wasn't there at that time, right. And at any rate, the strike had begun in Coachella. We had statewide contracts, and Tenneco was one of those companies that had grapes in Coachella, as well as Arvin and Lamont, as well as Delano. And so the strike had begun in Coachella on April 15th when the contracts ended. And in Ducourt, it was the off-season, not that many people were there. And by the time the harvest did shift up to there, there were thousands of people on strike and picket lines and thousands in jail that summer. But we lost the contracts. But for me, those 2 years were great years working under that contract. Some of the happiest years in my life. Then in the 1980s, I worked under the contract at the David Friedman Company. And a number of things had changed. I got my dispatch to the David Friedman Company. I'd been off staff and on staff again in the legal department, 1975, 76, 77, and had worked at some other companies. But I got a dispatch to the David Friedman Company because what I really liked working in was the grapes. That's the crop I liked the best.
But you had spent years between 73, when the sweetheart contract is signed, and the 80s, you had actually gone back on staff in the legal department.
Right, and doing leaflets. And I'd also spent 2 years at home. I was helping my mom. My grandfather was very elderly. And I'd gone to graduate school at Claremont Graduate School. I'd gotten a master's degree in public administration. And I was feeling that for all the strengths of the union in organizing and the benefits of the union in organizing, the real weak point in the whole union movement was union administration.
Mm-hmm.
And I still feel that.
So going home for 2 years was a product of being needed at home in some sense, but also part of this decision that there needed to be better administering, or was that
all of that? Plus, I was on probation. There had been strikes in 1972 against White River Farms and a company called Lamanuzzi and Pantaleo. They were bringing in these new machines that had been developed to pick wine grapes. Mm-hmm. And it didn't affect us at Tenneco, but in solidarity, we would go over and help them on the picket lines before we went to work. If we went to work at 6, we would go and maybe picket from 4:30 or 5 till 5:30 or 6, and then we'd go to work at our field. And we were all neighbors. It was all, you know, a mile down the road here or there. And one early morning, a supervisor's, the windows were smashed out of a supervisor's Mustang when he passed through the picket line. And when it got light, he came back out and told his rent-a-cops, his security guards, that the one that had broken his window was that one. He pointed at me. And I saw him pick up a rock and threw it through my window. And I didn't do it. But somebody on the picket line did do it. And the jury and the judge later told my lawyer, I know Adair didn't throw that rock, but somebody in the union did, and he's as good as anybody. And I got 60 days in jail. And I actually served 37 days in jail in Tulare County.
Why did you get out early?
Oh, good behavior. I was a very good prisoner. I didn't cause them any trouble.
Was it hard to be in jail?
Or? No, it was real boring when I was in the actual jail in Visalia. But then they moved us to a road camp, which was, it was like a farm labor camp. And there may have been some people in there for violent crimes, but in those days most of the crimes were a stolen credit card and hubcaps and kind of minor stuff, smoking marijuana. It wasn't like public drunk, kind of mild stuff. Anyway, it was an interesting experience.
But when you were in jail, you weren't signaled out as a union, or there was no
Though when I put a poster up by my bed, they took it down. Mm-hmm. They said there would be no politics here. No, okay, right. But
so then you served your 37 days, and what happened?
Then when I got out, the judge said this was after the strike had broken out. This was in April and May, and I think I got out in mid-May. And the strike was going on all through the Central Valley, from Arvin to Fresno, and thousands of people on picket lines, and hundreds and even thousands being arrested.
This was mid-May of 73?
This was, yeah, May. Mm-hmm. And then I think in June was the first assassination or murder of a farm worker, and then a second was killed in like July or August, and terrible violence. But the judge told me when I got out, he said, you're going to have 2 years probation, and if you're arrested with anything to do with the union, it's going to be a violation of your probation. And I'm going to throw the book at you, and you're going back to jail, you know, for throw away the key. So I thought, well, it's a good time to go home and help out my mother and go back to school for a while. But when the Agricultural Labor Relations Act went into effect, I took my oral exams for my PhD, I think on the, I don't know, it was mid-August, I think, and I think the Agricultural Relations Act was going to go into effect the 1st of September. And I took my oral exams, and they said, well, what are you going to write your thesis on? I said, well, I'm not sure I'm going to write my thesis, but my thesis is the union, and I'm going back to serve. And
this would be August, September of?
August of 1975 was when I went back on staff. And that was, and I just went up to Delano. I never was actually hired by the union. I would just appear and volunteer, and they'd put me to work. And at that point, I was working on leaflets and then began working on the legal department. And the new law, how are you doing on your tape?
Well, I think we can take a break and start up again.
Okay.
Go ahead without reintroducing ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And am I hooked up and on?
And we're hooked up and on.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We were talking about you had spent a couple of years working on your degree. You had taken your oral examinations in August or so of 75. The Agricultural Labor Relations Act is in, and you go back up and volunteer.
Yeah, I went back to Delano and was kind of working with my friend Tom Dalzell and kind of helping out on leaflets. And then Tom went down to the Imperial Valley where the campaign was going to be starting up in, well, the lettuce harvest down there begins about the end of November, December. And the Agricultural Labor Relations Act of California that had been passed was a compromise between the growers and the union and kind of filtered through the legislature and Jerry Brown, who was governor at the time. And it was a milestone act for agricultural workers in that it gave farm workers the right to organize, and it gave them the right to petition for union recognition. It gave them the right to go out on strike for recognition. It set up a system of unfair labor practices in which if the employer violated the worker's rights, he had a right to file an unfair labor practice before the state. So it really was a historic act, giving farm workers all these new rights. The problem with it was in a sense, it channeled the energy of the farm workers through this legal process, which was very dependent on filing forms for access, filing forms for recognition, filing forms for deciding the unit of the ranch, filing forms for the election, deciding who could vote and who couldn't. It became very formalized and structured. And also, in a sense, the union became very dependent on this legal definition of what was correct and what was not correct every step of the way in the process. Before, the workers were fed up, they went on strike. The growers would call out the cops, they'd beat up some people, they'd throw people in jail, but if they couldn't get the grapes picked, they were forced to sign a contract. Or the union would picket and boycott, and if they couldn't get the grapes sold, the company was forced to sign a contract. Now everything was channeled through the law, and immediately we began petitioning for elections all over the state and signing up workers and winning elections all over the state. But we also were losing elections. And in relation to the law, it had both pluses and minuses. And over the years, it's come to be more of a minus, I think, for union organizing than a plus, because it forces so much paperwork on the part of the workers that you almost need a lawyer to deal with it. And there were two of us in the legal staff that were not lawyers, Carol Schoengren and I, who took the position that if this law was to serve the workers, the job of the legal staff was to teach the workers how to use the law. And we worked out a manual of the steps for filing a petition for access and filing a petition. You had the right to go on the grower's property to a farm labor camp and sign up the workers, which was, the farmers freaked out over this, a violation of private property. All of these different legal steps and unfair labor practices, we in this manual, it was all blocked out, step A, step B, step C, first you do this, first you do that, examples of an unfair labor practice, if he threatens you, if the boss makes a speech in front of the workers and threatens you or coerces you or bribes you. It's basically following the National Labor Relations Act procedure, what's legal and what isn't. But we put it in very simple terms so that anyone could understand the things to look out for in an organizing campaign, what would be fair and what wouldn't be fair, and also for our own organizers. What can you promise and what can you not promise? And the group of lawyers that the union assembled at that time were some of the finest young lawyers in the country, and they were led by Jerry Cohen and Sandy Nathan, Barry Winograd, Tom Dalzell, and we were writing the law, and we knew the law so well. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I knew that law frontwards and backwards, and I could sit down. I ended up sitting down in a unit determination hearing before a judge with my old boss, Tenneco. And Tenneco had three lawyers, which were each, I'm sure, getting $1,000, $2,000 a day against me, a $5 a week lawyer, non-lawyer. And I beat their pants off because I knew that law frontwards and backwards, and I knew what we had to prove to show that Tenneco Farming Company in the Coachella Valley had three different but associated operations in the citrus and the grapes and in the dates. And even though each had separate bookkeeping and a separate division in the corporate structure, there were elements of them where they all came together. A tractor that moved from this farm to that farm, an irrigator that would irrigate this farm and also that farm, And I was able to prove that, in fact, though they had separate books, there were many, many points of convergence in which they all came together, and that Tenneco, the final decision for what went on, was made in Bakersfield. And all three of these units were reporting to Bakersfield, and there were many, many times when they were treated as one in the same operation.
Did you win?
Oh, yeah. It was a single election, and in fact, we won in the citrus, broke even in the grapes, and probably lost in the dates. I'm just guessing for that election. But we won the election overall. But I don't think we ever got a contract. We negotiated, 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 and that's the other problem with the labor relations law, is that if you're negotiating in good faith, and you have a smart lawyer that knows how to do it, he can negotiate and negotiate and negotiate and negotiate, and you just negotiated to death, and nothing ever happens.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it's even if a union goes through all, jumps through all the hoops to get an election and win an election, it then takes so long to negotiate under the law that it's almost worse than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, under various Republican governors, the Agricultural Labor Relations Board has gotten more and more conservative, so that the decisions now are almost always in favor of the employer and defending employers' rights and defending property rights. And the original law said it was in the interests of the people of California to promote the organization of farm workers, to bring peace to the fields, to bring peace and order. I've forgotten the exact wording now. But the idea was that California is better off if the employers and the employees sit down at the table and resolve their differences without strikes and boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
And the law is not being operated in that manner now. The law at this point is being operated in the interests, as it works out, in the interests of the employer, and the practical effect is to slow down organizing and to slow down negotiations to the point where nothing happens. It's very difficult to get a contract through
during
that law.
During the period that you're negotiating, work must go on. How is that handled?
Well, you're not allowed to strike if you're negotiating in good faith.
So whatever the existing prevailing
about, and they would use the fact that the workers had won an election to freeze the benefits. And especially in the late 70s and early 80s, when inflation was running just at horrendous percentages, this became a tremendous disadvantage. Gosh, you voted for the union, it meant you were voting for a wage freeze, because nothing ever happened. Gosh, I voted for the union and nothing happened.
Do you know if any of the manuals and things that you prepared for workers exist? Have they been archived?
I'm sure there's still copies. We had a copy in every union office, and in fact, at one point in 1976, the law was frozen. The legislature refused to fund the administration of the law, and it wasn't even in effect for like months and months and months. And that's when the union proposed Proposition, 14, which would have put the law into the state constitution. And that failed politically, but it created so much pressure on the legislature that they refunded the act, so it went back into effect. But those manuals, I'm sure, are still in La Paz and were in all the union offices. And they were an invaluable tool for enabling the workers to do the work themselves.
Yeah.
And Carol's and my job was going around to all the offices and making sure that the local staff knew how to use the manual, and elections that had been held and were being appealed by the grower lawyers. We taught the local staff how to line up witnesses and how to do the hearings, defend the elections we won, protest the elections we'd lost.
So I'd have to have lawyers.
It was lawyers, mm-hmm. but we were teaching the local staff to do that. But the union lawyers, there was a great incentive on the part of the union to use the union lawyers, who were so good, they really were better than we were. But when a union becomes dependent on lawyers, it loses a tremendous mobility and local power, and it's a bad situation when a union is dependent on a lawyer for a lot of these basic things.
But you were in working with the legal department. At some point, did you come on staff while you did that?
Yeah, I was on staff, mm-hmm. sort of. I was a volunteer. It was all of the last half of 1975, all of 1976, and all of 1977. And I was in charge of the Coachella office for the election campaigns of 1977, and in charge of all the unfair labor practices, the petitions for election, the petitions for access, defending the election victories that we won, protesting the ones we lost. The appeals that I wrote were in relation to the MELPAC ranch, which had about, 500 or 600 workers in the election. I can't quite remember. And then I was also involved in protesting the election at Coachella CID, Coachella Imperial Distributors, I think. And I wasn't as closely involved in that election, but I did write the brief.
And that happened in the throughout the year of 77?
77, yeah.
At the end of that, what did you?
But again, I wanted to get back to work in the fields, and the union had won the election at the David Friedman Company, which had actually remained under union contract since 1970 when they first signed. It was the only big grape ranch that never gave up the union contract. And there weren't any dispatches available when I left the union staff. I told Eliseo Medina, oh, I'm going to leave in the fall, and no, can you stay on one more month? Well, I'm going to leave in November, no, one more month. Finally, I left in December. And I think my first dispatch out to Friedman was actually in January of 1978. I worked for a couple of different companies in the citrus and grapefruit, oranges, lemons. Worked at a non-union ranch picking okra. That's the bottom of the barrel. If you ever want a low-paid job, okra, I think, has to be it. That was non-union and no benefits. But getting back to work in the grapes was great. A lot of things had changed. First of all, the dispatches at Friedman under the new contract were... they were recalls. If you had seniority at Friedman, you didn't need a dispatch. You were recalled. There had been an old system where, when I worked at Tenneco in the 70s, where the dues were year-round dues, and you paid $350 a month dues.
Mm-hmm.
And for that $350, even if you worked, I think if you worked even a minimum of 50 hours, you were covered by a life insurance policy of $1,000 or $2,000 for the next 12 months. If you worked 100 hours, or I've forgotten the different levels, but there were different levels. If you worked 100 hours or 300 hours or 500 hours or 600 hours, at each point, there were more benefits. So a steady worker had year-round benefits. A worker that worked a pretty long season, several hundred hours, might have benefits, insurance benefits, for instance, health insurance benefits, that would mm-hmm. continue for 6 months or 9 months after the layoff. So you had benefits that extended year-round. But on the other hand, you were expected to pay dues year-round. And you'd pay dues, usually you'd pay three, as I remember, we paid 3 months at a time. We'd go in and pay 10-50 dues, mm-hmm. would cover 3 months. But if the season ended and the worker went on up to Stockton or Sacramento or Oregon or back to Texas or back to Zacatecas or wherever, normally you weren't working, you didn't pay your dues.
Mm-hmm.
Now the problem came up when you returned the next year, and here you were a seniority worker, you'd finished the job last year, you wanted your job back. First of all, you had to wait in line for a dispatch, and there would be a, I think the first day was reserved for seniority workers, and the second day was for new workers. But still, you had to be sure you were there the first day, and not a day late, or you might miss that seniority dispatch. And then to get the job back, you had to be current in your dues. Well, this might be a real burden on workers that had been maybe not working for several months, maybe not working for 6 months, and returning after a long winter in Mexico and spending their last few dollars on gas to get back up. They finally get to Delano or Coachella or wherever, and they get to the union hiring hall, and oh yes, your name is on the list, you're a seniority worker, but we need your back dues. You owe us 6 months or 9 months back dues. Well, 9 months at $350 could be a significant hit for a worker mm-hmm. with two or three kids and expenses, and finally it got in the gas and made it in and barely, you know. And even if you work a week, then you have to wait another week for the paycheck. And I mean, how are you going to get through the next 10 days? And the union wants $30 or $40. And it had it also had a very bad effect on people that weren't familiar with the union, weren't familiar with the system, that might have been waiting in line, that could see the guy in front of them, maybe that had the money, passes the money through the window and gets the job, and then you're next in line, and they tell you, oh, you're not on the list. Come back tomorrow. And you're thinking, wait a minute, the guy in front of me paid the money and he got the job. Discrimination. You had to buy your job. That's not fair. And you might say, well, I worked here 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I've worked at this company for years. Did you work here last year? No, my mother was sick and we didn't come north or whatever. We didn't work here last year. Well, you're not on the list. But the worker may be thinking and may be telling other people, the guy in front of me got the job because he paid the money. So it was a very bad system, I mean, on the surface kind of image that it gave was very, very bad. That was changed in the new contracts. When I went to work for David Friedman in the 1978, the dues were 2% and they were deducted from your check. So you only paid when you were working. The benefits might still extend throughout the year, but you're only paying when you're working, and in fact, you never notice it, you never see it. It's just like Social Security and workman's compensation and all the other things. It's part of all those things that are deducted. Right. So there it goes. You never notice it, but you got all these benefits. So it was a tremendous step forward. But many, many people voted against us in those elections in 1975 and 1976 on the basis of that back dues. Oh, I was in the union and when I tried to get my job, they said I had to pay $20, $30 to get my job back, and that's not fair. And they voted for the Teamsters. Or they voted no union, or whatever. Another thing that worked against us in those elections in 1975 and 76 was a question of fines. When I was at Tenneco, our union meetings were in Delano. And we were about 15 miles north of Delano. It was quite a trip. Most of the people in the camp didn't have cars. There were only a few cars to take us down to town. We also had people in the crew, family members, that came down from Porterville, which was another 15 or 20 miles to the north. And we would work on an 8-hour day or even a 9-hour day in those days and come home tired at night in the afternoon, and then there'd be a union meeting that night. We'd have to go back to town for the union meeting. And in our crew, we always tried to make sure everybody had a ride and The people that drove the cars would expect you to chip in for the gas, but it wasn't like you were really being ripped off for the gas. But there were other crews that weren't as strong as we were, where, gosh, the guy that had the car wanted to make an extra buck or two. And if he was going to drive you to the union meeting, he wanted you to pay $5 or whatever. And for the families that lived up in Porterville for the north, it was like a 30 or 40 mile trip back to Delano, and then 30 or 40 miles back home. And the union meetings, which were conducted in two or maybe three or maybe four languages, could go on and on and on. Needless to say, we tried to have translation into Arabic, and there would be translation into Filipino and English and Spanish. We were a multicultural, multiracial crew. And there was a forewoman from one of the crews, a family crew out of Richgrove, who was very hostile to the union, hated the union. But she always went to the union meetings, and she had a group of people that always went with her. And she proposed, I remember at one point, well, I'm here, if I can come here, I don't know why everyone shouldn't come here, and I think people that don't come should be fined. And sad to say, there were a lot of real strong union people that agreed that, well, they should be fine, everyone should be here. And as I remember, it passed. And the only mitigating factor that we could get into it, that I could get into it, was that if you had a legitimate excuse. And so I made sure in our crew that if you couldn't come, you had a legitimate excuse. So I don't think anyone in our crew was ever fined, but lots of people were fined. And if they didn't pay, they were threatened with losing their jobs because they didn't go to the union meeting. And yeah, you want to build a strong union and solidarity and discipline and everything, but you're dealing with real life families that have kids and broken cars and headaches and a thousand reasons that you have to be aware of. And if you're so hardline fanatic that you're going to go out fining people right and left for not attending the meetings, I have a hunch a lot of those no votes in 1965 and 66 were somebody that had a real bad experience with something like that and resented it.
So by 75 or 76, there had been enough experience with the contracting, with this stuff, that there was a little bit of buildup of reasons to vote otherwise.
Oh, right. And there were ranches where the union had worked well and had been responsive, like the David Friedman Company. I think we won 93% of the votes. There were other companies where one community was overwhelmingly in favor of the union. It had brought them so many benefits. The Arab community, for instance, tended to vote overwhelmingly union because they'd gotten so many benefits from the union. It had opened up new ranches to them. It had opened up new camps to them. We dispatched the first Arabic irrigator in the history of California agriculture. There were certain jobs that traditionally had been reserved for Anglos, and usually the tractor drivers and irrigators on a ranch were Anglos. If there were Anglos, they would be in those steady jobs, a little bit better, little step up on the ladder. And the union insisted that when there was an opening, a Mexican or a Filipino or an Arab would have the same right as the son of the boss or the son of the mechanic or whatever. I mean, it was open to everyone. And just because you were white didn't mean that the mechanic's job should be saved for you. So the Arabs voted overwhelmingly in favor of the union. The Filipinos, many voted against the union simply because they had had a slightly privileged position under the old system that the union contracts had disrupted. And they had gotten new benefits, but they'd also lost a few privileges under the new system. And so it was in, we had many, many strong Filipino members, but we also lost a lot of of Filipino votes. The local workers, in many cases, the union was more beneficial to the local workers than, for instance, the people who came in from Texas or Mexico. Because if the company needed workers and they sent out a work order, we need workers on Thursday, and the order came to the union on Monday, the dispatch is going to be on Wednesday, well, the word would get around town right quick, and the local workers were there, and they were living there, and your neighbor told you that, hey, the union's going to have dispatches tomorrow, and call your comadre, and oh, I need a ride, and you put together three or four people, and you're there at 8 o'clock, and you got a job. And the people coming in from Texas or Zacatecas, and they get there 2 days later, and are there any jobs? Oh, there was a dispatch last week. You missed it. So those early contracts definitely benefited. There are winners and losers in any situation. Mm-hmm. And the union coming in tremendously disrupted the old system.
Uh-huh.
But if you read the official union history, it was justice and freedom and equality for all. Well, but there was more justice for some. I mean, let's admit it. Some people benefited more than others. That's always the case whenever you change a system. And the people that had a special relationship with that foreman, the foreman had lent the money. In the old days, the foreman was like the banker for that little community. And you might get up from Texas or from Mexico or wherever, and you're broke, and the foreman advances you $40 to help you make it for the next week until you can cash that first paycheck. Well, when the union is dispatching people, the foreman is much less inclined to lend money to someone he doesn't know. Before, he was lending money to someone from his village or his province in Mexico or the Philippines. Or he was lending money to the friend of the guy that always worked here, or the relative of the guy that had always worked here. There were all these personal relationships that the union tended to undermine. And freedom and justice for all, yeah, but when you're undermining these personal relationships, what takes the place of it? And there were personal relationships within the union. The woman running the hiring hall knew right away when the work order came in and when the dispatches were going out. And she had friends, and she had comadres, and people in Delano or in Poplar or in Lamont learned to make friends with somebody in the union office, because it's nice to have a friend in the union office, just like it's nice to have a friend at unemployment or the welfare or wherever. Here was an official behind the counter that knew how the rules worked and knew what you needed to get the dispatch. Well, you need to be there at 8 o'clock. You need to have a social security number, any number. You don't need the card, but you need the number. You need a number to give through the window. And if you've never been a member before, you need $10.50. And if you were a member before, you need to pay back your dues from whenever you stopped paying. And again, they're all in any bureaucratic situation, there are these personal connections that mean a lot. But the new contract at Friedman Eliseo Medina negotiated it in 1977, and it was in effect in 1978 when I went there. I thought it was a tremendous contract. We had the new health plan, had vision benefits, dental benefits. Some of them we didn't have in 1978, but we got them during the 80s, which just opened up a whole new world of benefits for union members that we'd never had before. And within each crew, we had a system of stewards that made sure the members knew about this. In every year that I was at Friedman, I was the steward for the vine-tying crew, And I was steward in Lupi Acosta's crew when I first started out. Then I moved up to Joe Balahadia's crew, which was the number one crew. I wasn't the steward in that. I've forgotten who was steward. It wasn't me. But then I moved down to the number five crew, Sammy Rodriguez, just because I was more comfortable there. It was a more, we didn't get quite as much work as they did in the number one crew. When there was a recall, if it's hot weather, and for instance in the harvest or the thinning, the grapes are beginning to get ready, but the whole ranch isn't ready all at once. This block is ready, that one's almost ready, this one's almost ready. The recall might be for crews number one, two, and three on the 1st of April, and crews number four and five, the 3rd of April, and so forth. And the layoff was also by seniority. And there's a little bit of work left, but not enough for all the crews. Well, you go in reverse order. And six and seven and six are laid off, and then five and four, and then three and two, and one was the crew that always worked the most. And so I did get a little bit more work in that number one crew, but Sammy Rodriguez had gone out on strike at Valdora in 1973, and was one of these foremen that was very strong for the union, and a big union family, and Caesar was his compadre, the godfather of his son, and I just felt real comfortable in that crew. It was a more easygoing crew. Again, you have crews in farm labor in which they have a reputation as being wino crews. I was in a wino crew at a company called Beckman and Bender, little tiny company, just had one crew. Well, they did a lot of drinking and real good people, but that's the truth of the matter. There were a lot of people that were borderline alcoholics, and we did good work at that crew. It wasn't that we screwed up the vines, but that was their people in agriculture, that, and this was a niche for them. Sammy's crew had a lot of smokers. Well, it's easy to grow marijuana. The Mexican community or Latino community has been growing marijuana for thousands and thousands of years, and just because the red, white, and blue flag is flying doesn't mean they're going to change a thousand years of tradition on that. And Sammy's crew had a lot of smokers in it. Well, I liked that. It added an ambiance, something. But still a very high quality job, and proud of our work. And I was in the negotiations. If you ever have a graduate student interested in going through the day-to-day negotiations of a union contract, I was on the ranch committee in 1982 maybe, when we renegotiated the contract and Gilbert Padilla came down from La Paz. And the workers at David Friedman Company were so strong that the union would decide that the ranch committee would decide that tomorrow we're going to work till 8:30 and then we're going to have a rally and stop. And then we'd meet the next day and say, well, tomorrow we're going to work all day, no matter. Tomorrow we're not going to work at all. We're going to report to the fields, and when he blows the whistle, nobody's going to work. And we could control the crews like that, 100%. We were in complete control of the ranch. And the foreman in my crew would come up and ask me, how many hours are we going to work today? And I always told the foreman, because it was important to me, just the foreman wasn't our enemy, and the grapes weren't our enemy, and what we were trying to prove to the company was we were in this together. They couldn't get the grapes picked without us. But on the other hand, I didn't like to see grapes picked that were just lying out in the fields. And if the foreman didn't know when we were going to stop and couldn't plan, and people just picked, and then at 8:30 left, and all those grapes were left out in the field, in the 110 degree heat, they'd lose the grapes. And that there are people that said, who cares? But I cared. I thought that was bad. I always tried to show that respect for the company and the foreman, that we weren't trying to destroy the grapes. We were trying to tell them that we were in this together. And they had to respect us, but there's no reason why we shouldn't respect them on that level. How are we doing on time or tape?
We have a couple more minutes. I want to ask you something specific.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that if a student were interested in this period of renegotiating the Friedman contract in 82, is it because it was a particularly interesting renegotiation?
Oh, I think it was fascinating. And it was at one of those points, this was one of the strongest workforces under the union contract in the history of the union. I mean, there have been many ranches that were strong, but here is a nice, close example of a workforce. Most of the workers are still there. I mean, a student could interview one-on-one the people that participated in this. Gilbert Padilla was sent down from La Paz to be in charge. From La Paz's point of view, Caesar came down and met with Lionel Steinberg, the boss, trying to get the final push done to get the contract written, but never met with the committee, which I criticized Caesar for that. I mean, my relationship with Caesar was as a brother, and I thought he should have shown us the respect to come and meet with us. But he met with Gil Padilla and with Lionel and urged Lionel to sign.
But, for example, in order to get the perspective of the ranch committee, that's a matter of finding and interviewing the people. They're not real documents.
But I have all the documents, day-to-day notes. They're all there, every minute, and the memories. And at one point, we had been preparing, the ranch committee had been preparing for the negotiations beginning in April. And the union headquarters in La Paz said, yeah, we're gonna get down, we're gonna help you, we're gonna get down. Well, they finally sent Gilbert down in June. The harvest had already started. And we were very annoyed that it was starting so late, because we have a very short season. And once the harvest is over, we have no negotiating power at all. There's no work at all in Coachella until December in the pruning. So we had to get that negotiations, we had to get the contract wrapped up in a very short period of time. And in 1980 or 82? It may have been 1980. It was a period of tremendous inflation, I remember.
Oh, yes.
And prices were just going up and up and up and up and up. And we had negotiated a contract, Eliseo had negotiated a contract in 77 that I think was three something an hour, and it had wage raises that looked pretty good in 1977, but were just totally out of line by, I think it may have been 1980. And we were behind where we'd been in 1977 because of inflation.
Sure.
And so we were roaring to go and had meetings and what we were gonna go for, and we were going for $5 an hour. It was like over a dollar an hour raise. But we felt we could get it. And when Gilbert finally got down there, and he's the godfather of my daughter, so I feel very, very close to Gilbert, and he organized me. He was the one that convinced me to join the union.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with him in Texas, and I worked with him in Philadelphia. But told him in no uncertain terms, we're starting real late. We're, you know, we've got to run to make up for lost time. And the first meeting with the company, we presented our proposals, and they said, give us time to study, and we're going to come back with a counterproposal on whenever it was, Friday, but it wasn't the next day. It was like several days later. And we objected on the committee, but Gilbert said, you know, you've got to give them time to study our proposal. And gosh, I remember that day when we met with them, which was like several days later. We told the workers when they finished work at the ranch, and up to then there'd been no work stoppages, nothing. We told them, when you finished work at the ranch, meet under the Alamo tree, the cottonwood, wait for us, and we'll report back to you. And we were going to be meeting with the company at noon and we hoped we'd be back there by 2, and work was over. Well, we didn't get back till 4. It was 110, and some workers had been drinking, which so the setting was very, very bad. But the company came in with a counterproposal of 2 cents. And the workers were so enraged, and Gilbert Padilla